morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. I'm sorry that we're running a little bit behind, but things are hectic, as they might say. So we have a couple of things that we want to do. I want to first acknowledge that we have the Westview High School and Clackamas High School speech and debate classes here. Thank you all very much for being here. Now it looks like they're leaving as soon as I said. Oh, I hope it was anything I said. Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being here. And you'll be. We do have a hearing overflow room in E. And so if we need to use that, please feel free. We'll be making announcements for those who are coming forward. I also understand that Representative Huffman is here in support and showing support for House Bill 2038A as well as 2571A. And as we get further along, if you want to, John, I don't know if you want to actually speak or not. Not yet.
Open them up real
quick. No, I'm not ready.
I can go vote and you can get on with business.
Oh, you need, okay. Let me just take care of one other thing that I want to put on the record so we can clear some people out. House Bill 3347 is set for a work session. We are still waiting for an answer from the Department of Justice on a question that the chair raised, and so that is not going to be worked today. It will be carried over. It will be posted for work session this next week. And so let's go ahead and put that down for a carryover, and we'll figure out what the date is going to be, or we'll repost. I guess we could do either of those. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, John, I'm going to go ahead and open up for the purpose of taking your testimony. Public hearings on House Bill 2038A as well as House Bill 2571A.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and committee members. John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. Just wanted to get on the record that House Bill 2038 and 2571 are my bills, have my fingerprints all over them. But there are certified smart people in the room that are going to testify on both of them. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to get that on the record. Now I'll go vote in my Ed subcommittee and let you guys move along with important stuff.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And I assume there's no questions.
Thank you.
Yes. Keep it there for another 20 minutes.
Well, yeah, but not on those bills.
That's fine. So. Those bills, they're fine on that. Okay, so, and then I also understand Mayor Hells is here on House Bill 2571, but you have a very tight schedule that needs to, you need to get back to Portland. So what I'm going to do is recess right now the public hearings on House Bill 2038A, as well as House Bill 2571A. I'm now going to open up for the purpose of taking testimony from Mayor Hells, House Bill 2571. Laura, I would like to have a review on that one.
Absolutely. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2571A is sponsored by Representatives Williamson, Huffman, Frederick, and Senator Burdick, among others. We have no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal statement issue. This bill passed the House Judiciary Committee with a vote of 7-2, and it passed the House floor with a vote of 50-9, with one excused. We do have a proposed -88 amendment before us today that adds ongoing criminal investigations to the exceptions for recording retention requirements. We don't have the paperwork back on that yet, though, so it is not ready to move. The use of personal cameras worn upon a police officer's person, known as body cameras, has recently been a topic of national debate. Currently in Oregon, there is no requirement that a police officer wear body cameras. Body cameras, however, are becoming increasingly popular among some of Oregon's law enforcement agencies. House Bill 2571A does not require the use of body cameras in Oregon. The bill, however, requires law enforcement agencies to establish policies and procedures for retaining recordings from body cameras worn upon a police officer's person to record their interactions with members of the public while on duty. House Bill 2571A also defines terms. It outlines public records law exemptions and exceptions to those exemptions. It additionally, it mandates that all faces must be blurred to render them unidentifiable before disclosure. The bill also clarifies evidence and discovery rules as they pertain to body cameras.
All right, thank you. Mayor Hells, why don't you come forward? Representative Williamson, and I don't know if it was Andy coming up as well. Okay. So while they're getting settled, we have a very large group. Let me just ask, are there any other representatives or senators that are in the House?
There were.
All right.
All right. Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jennifer Williamson, State Representative from House District 36. This bill you have before you today is a product of a lot of hard work and a lot of stakeholders' engagement. And so I just want to start by thanking everyone who worked very, very hard on this bill, including my staff, the city staff, the speaker's staff, among others. So it's well documented in social science research that we alter our behavior when we know we're being watched. And we alter it even more if the watcher is considered an authority figure. A 2013 study done in Southern California tested this theory in relation to law enforcement body cameras by posing a simple question: does the use of body cameras result in better public safety outcomes for both officers and the public? As part of a one-year random control trial, half of the officers in the Rialto Police Department wore body cameras during their shifts and the other half did not. The results were conclusive. In the group wearing cameras, there was a 50% reduction in use of force incidents that, over the control group. And in the small number of incidents that were recorded, all were found to be initiated by a member of the public. This is in contrast with a control group where 4 of 17 incidents were determined to be initiated unnecessarily by the officer. During the trial, there were 10 times fewer citizen complaints against the department than the previous 12 months. It was clear the use of body cameras had a positive impact on everyday interactions between police and the public. While the footage can increase transparency and accountability, this study proved that the very presence of cameras seems to discourage the escalation of violence in the first place, keeping officers and citizens safer. This bill creates essentially a policy floor for law enforcement agencies that want to use body cameras. It is not a mandate. There were many bills introduced this session that would have mandated the use of body cameras, and this is not one of them. Let me tell you a little bit about what's included in this bill. This bill requires that a camera be on whenever an officer has reasonable suspicion that a violation of the law is taking place. It may not be turned off until that contact with the individual suspected of the violation is terminated. Local agencies may adopt exemptions to this rule, provided that they are based on reasonable concerns for the privacy of the officer or the public, the safety of the officer or the public, or exigent circumstances. I want to make sure it's clear on the record as well that this bill is not intended to negatively impact any current community policing practices or unduly restrict agencies from crafting an appropriate policy for their community. This bill also requires mandatory retention of non-event footage in order to comply with both public records law and the Oregon Tort Claims Act. To protect against inappropriate use of the database that has footage off from the body cameras, the bill makes that footage accessible only for legitimate law enforcement purposes. And this bill also includes a ban on facial recognition technology. And the reason that that was included is currently that's not being used in Oregon for any of the jurisdictions that use body cameras. But those of us who worked on the bill felt it was an important enough policy conversation if law enforcement were to start using facial recognition technology that we wanted to have that conversation here in the legislature and not try to have it after the fact, after that technology was already being used. So you will hear lots about a complex and somewhat controversial part of this bill, whether or not body camera footage should be exempt from public records requests. Across the country, states and cities are grappling with this and how to strike the appropriate balance between accountability and privacy when it comes to releasing this footage. The bill in front of you strikes what I believe is a good balance with, like I said, the stakeholders that we had at the table. And those interests span the spectrum from those who wished footage that the footage is completely available and those who want it to be non-accessible and not disclosed for any reason. So the Section 5 of this bill, I think, comes close to balancing all of these interests. It's a middle ground that allows for footage to be released if it's in the public interest, whether the incident recorded involved use of force or not. This bill does not change current public record law that allows for exemptions in cases of internal investigations or court proceedings. This section also includes a provision that requires the blurring of all faces upon release of the footage so that the privacy of bystanders as well as those involved and law enforcement are protected. this technology is still very new, and part of the goal of this bill was to give enough flexibility for local jurisdictions to adopt the use of body cameras without a mandate from the state on how to use them. And you'll hear a lot from folks, like I said, who are stakeholders in this arena. I am hoping that with the use of body cameras, we keep a close watch on how they're being used. And this is not the end of this conversation. I'm sure in 2016 we'll have a conversation about it, and 2017 and beyond. And so I think this is a good start. I think this bill will encourage law enforcement to reach out to their communities to craft policies that fit the unique situations for each of the communities in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor?
Thank you very much, Chair Pozanski. It's a pleasure for me to be here with you and to support this well-crafted bill that Representative Williamson just described. We also at the City of Portland believe that this bill does strike that appropriate balance between the many interests involved in these issues. And obviously the Dash 8 amendment that Ms. Hansel just mentioned is one more fine-tuning to the bill that's needed. But we do think that this language is the correct language for those of us who lead local police agencies to go use this technology under appropriate state policy. We'll have a lot of policy work to do ourselves, of course. Police officers are governed not only by state law, but by massive amounts of local policy, and we'll write our policy to conform with this law, and we believe we can do that.
I need you to put your name on the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland. I'm always having to correct people that fail to do that at my council, so thank you. You know, I've been mayor for 2.5 years. During that time, we've been working really hard on building a relationship of trust and accountability between our police officers and our citizens. And frankly, doing that at a time when nationally there have just been tragic and catastrophic breaches of that relationship of trust. So this is a difficult time in police work, but we've made a lot of progress. And we've also been required to make a lot of progress because we're under a Department of Justice settlement about how we use force, particularly with people that are in mental health crisis. And again, I'm proud of the progress that we've made. We've changed how we train our officers. We've changed the rules for the use of force. We've changed how we discipline officers who fail to follow policy. And we've actually carried out that discipline on a regular and systematic and consistent basis. So I'm proud of the progress that we've made. And I believe that the use of body camera technology, which our police bureau supports and our police union supports, is the right thing to do. Let me just illustrate this a little bit with some real-life examples, bookending the service that I've had so far as police commissioner in the City of Portland. In the first few weeks that I was on the job, I got one of those 2 a.m. phone calls that mayors get from their police chief because we'd had a use of force incident, and I went out to Adventist Hospital where our officers had shot and killed a man. The worst situation for any police officer and for any police chief and for any mayor. And a young couple in an apartment nearby who'd been shepherded out of the way by police officers as the incident unfolded held their iPhone up over the windowsill of their apartment and recorded the incident. That recording turned out to really make clear that that incident was tragic. It was really suicide by cop, but understandable in terms of the use of force. Last Sunday, I was, again, as mayor, you get these calls at inconvenient times. I was attending a concert with my wife, got a call from the police chief that we'd had a use of force incident. It was a man who had had a mental health crisis, had cut himself with a knife, broken into a neighbor's house, threatened her and her children, and then came running across the street with the knife extended towards two of our officers who shot him and wounded him. He's in OHSU, we believe, recovering. That was a broad daylight incident in a neighborhood. There were a lot of witnesses, both other officers and citizens. But when these things happen in the middle of the night or off in a quiet corner of the city, having this technology in the cases where our officers use their authority appropriately helps make clear that they've done the right thing, even if the results are tragic. But it also, as Representative Pozanski illustrated through the statistics, changes our officers' behavior in positive ways. So I believe, as someone who wants our police bureau to do the right thing in all cases, that this technology, properly used, properly governed by the bill in front of you and by our own policies, will make Portland safer and make the truth safer. And I think it's great public policy and commend this work that the staffs and the legislators here have done with the stakeholders so well. I think this strikes the balance and will be good law. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Andy, were you making comments too?
Please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank Representative Williamson and her staff for their leadership on this issue. Also wanted to thank Representative Huffman Frederick and Senator Burdick and others who have been involved in this. It's been a lot of work. We really appreciate everybody's involvement, and I think we've landed in the right place that balances the competing interests of privacy and transparency and allows body cameras to be implemented and used in a reasonable way in communities across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on this in the sense of recessing it. We will be coming back to it. My understanding, this bill is not going to be worked today because I believe there may be some pending amendments that are being drafted. So with that understanding, let me just make sure I set up correct numbers. We are recessing House Bill 2571. Now I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2038A. This is the one that, so I'm reopening this one. And so why don't we go ahead and get the cover on that since we didn't do it before.
Yes, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. House Bill 2038A is sponsored by Representative Huffman. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. It passed the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water with one member excused, and it passed the House floor with a vote of 59-1 excused. We don't have any amendments before us today. So Oregon's recreational use statute and includes a Legislative Assembly declaration that it is the public policy of the state to encourage landowners to make their land available to the public for recreational purposes. Recreational purposes is defined to include a wide range of activities. Aviation activities, however, are not included. Out of all Western states, only Oregon and Colorado currently fail to include aviation in their RUS. House Bill 2038A amends Oregon's RUS to include aviation activities. Specifically, the bill limits the liability of private landowners for personal injury, death, or property damage arising from the use of land for aviation activities unless, number one, the owner is contacted by the pilot prior to flight. Number two, the owner provides permission to the pilot to use their land. And number three, the owner exercises gross negligence causing injury, death, or property damage related to the flight. House Bill 2038A does not apply to owners of public airstrips. This bill is ready to move today.
All right, thank you. So I've got Mary Rosenblum, Dave Honeycutt, and Art Towers. If the three of you would please come forward. As they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2038A? All right, who would like to start off? Mary, if you'll give us your name before you can give us your testimony.
Yes, Mary Rosenblum. I am a resident of Canby, Oregon. I come here today wearing two hats. One is as a landowner. I am a part landowner of Dietz Air Park, which is a private airstrip, not for public use. And I am also the president of Oregon Pilots Association, so I'm also a pilot. And this bill serves both groups. It serves the landowners by exempting them from liability if aircraft land on their property uninvited, which does occasionally happen. Most pilots are very polite and respectful, but we do have people who have aircraft that are capable of landing on agricultural land or will occasionally land on private airstrips without invitation. And this is certainly a concern for those of us who own private strips, since if there is an accident, the insurance company may come after us, even though our strip is well maintained and can support a wide range of aircraft. As a pilot, there are many places where landowners have private strips, especially in the eastern part of the state, where we have a lot of lovely recreational land that's really only accessible by aircraft or by jeep trails, which are fairly damaging to the environment. And many of these landowners deny permission for people to use their land because they are afraid of liability consequences. And so this bill does not only open up more recreational land in Oregon that that has actually an economic benefit for local municipalities, where there are places where if I go land on a private airstrip, I may walk into town and go fishing and have meals at the restaurant and enjoy the land where I otherwise would not be able to access it. And as a landowner, for people who choose to come and land on our strip, we are protected.
Thank you for your testimony. Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of 2038A. Let me just, for the record, one of the bones of contention that we had with the original bill over on the House side was that the original bill amended the recreational use statutes. The amendments to this bill make it clear that this bill is not amending the recreational use statutes. I want to put that on the record that there'll be peace in the valley if we make it clear we are not amending the recreational use statutes. As Mary said, the two parts of the bill: number one, to protect property owners example is the farmer who has a paraglider or a hot air balloon or something land in their field. It exempts those property owners from liability. And the other one is the private or restricted airstrips. The goal of the bill, and I think what we hope the bill will do, is allow owners of private or restricted airstrips to open that land, to open that airstrip up for public use, to encourage the aviation community and the owners of those airstrips to allow folks to come in and use that airstrip, which opens up a significant number of potential landing spots for recreational pilots. The bill does not apply if the two property owners who charge for the use of the airstrip. The bill does not apply to public airstrips, so PDX, you don't get any liability protection under this bill or any of the large public airstrips. And with the amendments, and I want to thank Mr. Towers and the Trial Lawyers Association for working with us on the amendments. With the amendments, we have a good bill that I don't believe has any opposition.
All right, thank you. Art?
My name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and as I've testified before this committee, feels like every week for quite a while, we are squeamish about limitations on liability. But we do feel that thanks to the good work of the proponents, we've been able to reach a good compromise with House Bill 2038A. I do also want to state for the record that taking this language out of the recreational immunity statutes was very, very important to us in terms of garnering our support. I do believe that the bill is a success because it enhances the rights of property owners, but also preserves the right of Oregonians to get their day in court. It doesn't set up any artificial barriers to make it difficult for a case to get to a jury. It doesn't create any extraordinary timelines for a suit to be brought, but it does require pilots and their passengers to meet a tougher standard of proof for than ordinary negligence. It also rewards pilots that follow the protocols and follow the rules. And so for those reasons, we do support the bill. Again, someday we'd like to visit about how to make it easier for airstrip operators and others who are seeking immunity to be able to afford insurance, but that's a matter for another day. So thank you very much, and again, we do support the bill as amended.
All right, thank you. Is there any questions?
I just have a real quick question.
Okay.
It says that unless the owner is contacted by the pilot prior to the flyer, the owner provides permission to the pilot to use their land. Is saying you can land here at your own risk giving permission? I'm just wondering if that would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I believe the answer to that would be yes. The FAA requires a pilot in order to land on a private airstrip to contact the owner of that airstrip and receive permission prior to landing on the property. If the pilot would contact the owner and receive permission from the owner prior to landing on the site, then the limitations in subsection 3B of the bill would kick in, and you would go from a from an absolute liability standard to a gross negligence standard.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2038A. Open up a work session on House Bill 2038A.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2038A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2038A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. We'll ask Senator Johnson to carry the bill. If not, then the chair will carry 2038A.
She's a pilot, so.
Yeah, I think she'll do that. So with that, we'll close the work session. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2333.
Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2333 comes to us at the request of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal statement issued on this bill. This bill did pass the House Judiciary Committee with one member excused, and it passed the House floor with a vote of 58-2 excused. We don't have any amendments before us today. In 2007, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2366, which amended Oregon's minority tolling statute. The goal of House Bill 2366 was to extend the statute of limitations for actions brought by parents in an effort to reach consistency with the statute of limitations applicable to children's claims arising from the same incidents. When the bill was drafted, however, changes were made to the language that were not caught at that time and have since had unintended consequences, specifically removing the wording or rewording an action mentioned in to an action that is subject to the relevant ORS sections rendered the statute inapplicable to claims brought under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. House Bill 2333 aims to correct this unintended consequence by clarifying language to state applicability to actions mentioned in relevant ORS sections. Additionally, House Bill 2333 asserts that if it causes the revival of a claim formerly barred under ORS Section 12.160, addressing suspension for minors and persons who are insane, immediately before its effective date, then that cause of action must be commenced within the time prescribed as amended.
All right. Thank you. Aaron Olson is scheduled to testify. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2333? While she's getting situated, I want to put on the record this bill will be carried over. I understand there's going to be some additional work. But we wanted to go ahead and get Ms. Olson's testimony since she's here.
Thank you, Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Olson. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. This issue came to my attention not as a result of one of my cases, but as a result of a situation brought to my attention by others. And it turned out to have been the result of a two-word error in legislation that was brought in 2007. I proposed a change to the law that corrected that two-word error to the Procedures and Practice Committees, and it seems to be a fairly not controversial change. However, Senator Gelser has brought up a concern that we do think should be addressed, and we think it should be addressed on a broader scale, but for purposes of this bill, we have the benefit of a Court of Appeals decision that allows us to apply a definition that eliminates some the use of the word insane from the bill that will correct this bill and maintain its broad purpose in allowing people who are what was then defined as insane to apply to get the benefits of the minority tolling law. I have proposed some amendments to Senator Gelser, and I understand that that's why the work session is going to be delayed. For purposes of legislative history, the language I took to propose the amendment comes from a case called Simonson versus Ford Motor Company. It's at 196 or App 460. That's a case in which the Court of Appeals defined for purposes of this minority and the tolling statute what insane means. And what I did was just propose that we use that definition rather than the word. It doesn't correct the other problems and offensive language in the statutes across the board, but it does deal with it in this case, and we have committed to undertaking corrections to the other statutes at a later date. So on behalf of there are two children right now who are directly affected by this bill on their behalf, I would ask that you pass this as amended.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. As I asked, I'll ask once again, anyone else wanting to give testimony on House Bill 2333? Not seeing anyone, we'll close that public hearing. We will schedule this for a work session for next week. We'll plan on next week. We'll have it posted by tomorrow as required. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on our next bill, which is going to be House Bill 3164A.
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, House Bill 3164A is sponsored by Representative Benz and Representative Hoyle at the request of Pacific Hardware and Implement Association. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. The bill passed the House Business and Labor Committee unanimously, and it passed the House floor with 51 ayes and 9 excused. We don't have any amendments before us today, but there are some amendments in the works that the stakeholders have been working on that we'll probably hear about. So Oregon's equipment dealer protection laws address provisions governing agreements between retailers and suppliers of farm implements. The statute outlines reasons constituting good cause for which a supplier may terminate, cancel, or not renew an agreement or change the retailer's competitive circumstances with immediate notice and no right for the retailer to cure any deficiency. A supplier cannot make a change in a retailer's competitive circumstances without good cause. The term change in competitive circumstances is defined to mean a material detrimental effect on a retailer's ability to compete with another retailer selling the same brand of farm implements. House Bill 3164A clarifies the conditions under which a supplier may claim good cause to terminate, cancel, or fail to renew or make a change in competitive circumstances. The bill also modifies the definition of change in competitive circumstances to include an event, act, or omission that has a negative impact, whether or not the agreement between the retailer and supplier allowed or provided for the event, act, or omission. Additionally, the bill increases the supplier notice requirement from 12 to 18 months in advance of their intent to terminate, cancel, or not renew an agreement or to cause a change in the competitive circumstances for the retailer when there is good cause based on the retailer's failure to meet marketing criteria. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right. So Roger and Paul, why don't you both come up? This purpose of the testimony today will be kind of just go over where we're at, understand the parties have agreed to language. We just got to get it wordsmithed to the point of where it's in a appropriate form for the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Pacific Northwest Hardware and Implement Association. I'm hopefully in a letter passed out from the executive director of the association about this bill. I won't go into great detail of it. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. They have their annual meeting right now is over in Boise. It's the Tri-State Association, so they had to travel to Boise this year for their meeting. So just thank you for hearing the bill. And I've been working with Mr. Cosgrove and others trying to come to an agreement on the language for specifically for subsection 2 of section 1. We've reached agreement. We're waiting now to have legislative council draft that in a manner that reflects our agreement. Sometimes that takes one or two tries. So, Mr. Chair, attached to the testimony, you will see that is on the third page of the testimony is the language that we reached agreement on, and it deals with that section on what the definition of change of competitive circumstances is. With that, sometimes people wonder why there would be an emergency clause in this bill. It was agreed to in the House to put an emergency clause on the piece of legislation because there are different manufacturers who are in the process of renegotiating or asking their dealers to sign new agreements currently and during this fiscal or during this calendar year. So the manufacturers agreed to an emergency clause so that all these new agreements will be covered by this new statute. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't need to read the testimony to you from Mr. Moore. You can read yourselves. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you for that consideration. Paul?
Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove, representing John Deere, one of the members of the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. I'd just like to thank Mr. Beyer and his client for working with us. When Mr. Beyer testified during the work session in the House committee, as your staff reported, it went out of the committee unanimously. He mentioned that there was a one word we were still negotiating. That is still correct. We finally negotiated that one word just the last few days, and that's what's being drafted by Legislative Council. So I'd appreciate his willingness to continue to work with us on that and to find a resolution that's satisfactory to all of the parties. So thank you very much.
Thank you. questions?
No question, Mr. Chair. I don't think I need a conflict of interest, but I am personally interested in this legislation. So,
but I think you're a large enough class.
I'm a large enough class, but I do have actually
farm implements.
I have John Deere, Case International, and Kubota, so I kind of cover the spectrum. So,
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank Senator Cruz for being a customer of one of our association members.
And of my client as well. So thank you so
win-win.
Much.
I know. All right. Thank you all very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3164A with the understanding that we're going to be scheduling this for work session once we get the paperwork back. And so that will be done and will be posted by tomorrow afternoon. With that, I'm now going to move into our next bill for a public hearing, House Bill 2693. All right, so we'll open it up. Staff, Laura's asked me to, I guess, give the disclaimer here. So this next bill is going to have sensitive material. This is a warning for those who are of all ages in this room. Please be aware that we are going to have some sensitive material discussed. Those who need to leave the room, please do so. Senator Cruz will be right back, though. All right.
A trend in this committee.
It is. So, yeah, I'm dropping off members, as we say. So, Sharon, you're here. Harmon, where is Sharon? I saw her. Oh, there she is. All right. Why don't you come up? She's the only one that's scheduled at this point to give testimony, but let me ask if there is anyone else for House Bill 2693. All right. The warning has been given. I'm not sure where we're going with this, but I'll have the gavel ready just in case. Yes, and Laura, please.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2693 is sponsored by Representative Gomberg. We have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this bill. The bill passed the House Judiciary Committee unanimously. It also passed the House floor with a vote of 59-1 excused, and we have no amendments before us today. The sexual assault of an animal is currently a crime under ORS 167.333. Current Oregon law, however, fails to address related activities, including the creation or purchase of visual recordings depicting animal sexual assault. House Bill 2693 creates a Class A misdemeanor crime of encouraging the sexual assault of an animal when a person, number one, knowingly possesses or controls for the purposes of arousing or satisfying the sexual desires of the person or another, a visual recording of a person engaged in sexual conduct with an animal, and two, knows or is aware of and consciously disregards the fact that the creation of the visual recording involved the sexual assault of an animal. House Bill 2693 additionally defines relevant terms, raises the crime of sexual assault of an animal to from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, and increases the amount of time an offender is prohibited from possessing animals from 5 to 15 years. House Bill 2693 applies to conduct occurring on or after its effective date. The bill is ready to move.
All right. Thank you. Sharon?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, wow, what a buildup to testimony. I don't know if I'm going to disappoint you or give you a sense of relief. I have no pictures. So, you know, we've been talking about this issue in Oregon for a number of years. And our agency both serves as a law enforcement unit under the state of Oregon. And also we have a forensic services division that helps other law enforcement agencies in the prosecution and the gathering of evidence for prosecution of animal crimes. And too often, sexual assault of an animal, we're presented with often dead animals. We're often presented with no evidence. We have animals that have healed after time has gone by. But with the age of electronic media, too often we find that the evidence exists on cell phones and laptops and publications. This bill helps close that loophole in the promotion and the monetization of this crime. And it also brushes up against what we find is the increasing link between human interpersonal violence and animal abuse. Often the victims of bestiality or sexual assault of an animal are women and children who are forced into this. The animals certainly are harmed. Many of them die as a result of the assault. But it's the women and children that are also forced into it. This bill gives us another tool. It helps close the door on this activity. Thank you for your support of House Bill 2693.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions from anyone? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2693, open up a work session on House Bill 2693. Senator Cruz.
Chair, I move House Bill 2693 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2693 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. The chair will carry 2693 to the floor. We'll close that work session, and we're going to move into our next bill. And this is going to be opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3468.
As Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3468 is sponsored by Representative Williamson. We have no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal statement issued on this bill. We also have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. House Bill 3468 passed the House Judiciary Committee unanimously, and it passed the House floor with a vote of 59-1 excused. We don't have any amendments before us today. Multiple studies show a direct link between violence against animals and violence against humans, especially within the context of domestic violence, where abusers use animals, specifically the threat of harming an animal, as a means of achieving submission. House Bill 3468 makes it a crime of coercion when one compels or induces another person to engage in certain conduct by instilling fear that they will cause physical injury to an animal.
All right. Thank you. I have two individuals that are scheduled to testify. Sharon, you're back on the list, so come on up. And then Rachel Solray, I believe. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 3468? Okay. Ladies, if y'all can kind of keep it short, that would be great, because we have two more bills with a lot of people.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Solray. I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County, and I specialize in domestic violence, as you heard last week. As we just discussed, the link between animal abuse and interpersonal violence is well established. Studies have shown that pet abuse is one of the four most significant indicators who is at greatest risk of becoming a domestic violence batterer. Batterers who abuse pets are more dangerous and use more violent and controlling behaviors than those who do not harm animals. 12 separate studies have reported that between 18% and 48% of battered women and their children delay leaving abusive situations in fear of what might happen to their animals. And women who seek safety at shelters are nearly 11 times more likely to report that their partners hurt or killed their animals than women who have not experienced domestic abuse. Children exposed to violence towards animals are also more likely to eventually engage in domestic violence. The connections here are so clear that many U.S. communities have started to cross-train social service and animal control agencies in how to recognize signs of domestic violence. This is a huge red flag about abuse towards animals and humans, and therefore we need to intervene as early as possible in order to ensure the safety of the victims of our community as well as the pets. A pet is often the only source of comfort or safety to a victim of domestic violence. Therefore, this is a powerful tool for the abuser to maintain control, influence, or gain or diminish a victim's autonomy. Victims often stay in or return to homes of domestic violence because few shelters in Oregon actually can take their pets as well. We would like to be able to hold abusers accountable for these types of coercive threats, which unfortunately are not irregular towards the animals. We also must remember that just because there's an act of violence towards an animal doesn't mean that we can necessarily prosecute it under the animal abuse laws if there isn't a show of physical injury. This is a minimal change to the current existing coercion law, which essentially says that somebody is attempting to force somebody to do or not do something that they have a legal right by instilling a fear through threats. And currently, that's certain things like a threat of physical injury to another or to falsely testify. This bill just adds that a threat to an animal is also something that would be coercive in nature under this statute. This statute will help prosecutors tremendously in holding abusers accountable and providing safety for victims and their pets, and I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Sharon?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society. I'm really proud to be an Oregonian, that we recognize as a society the victims are just different. Some have two legs, some have four legs. It's the same crime, and it's the same people. Too often, our office gets involved because it's the animal that's the victim, and sometimes that's the first entree for a victim of domestic violence to reach out, because they can speak up for their pet, but they can't speak up for themselves. We're really appreciative of the efforts to create this link, because I think we'll end up with a more compassionate society where all our most vulnerable victims have protection. We stand here in support of House Bill 3468.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Thatcher.
There is a difference between pets and food animals, correct? I mean, because some are intended to be killed, right?
Yeah.
Unlawfully. Is that where this all hangs, is the unlawful injury of an animal? I just don't want to, somebody threatening to kill Bessie, the cow who's going to be going to the slaughterhouse anyway, as being coercion. I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's a difference there in the law as written.
In other words, is good animal husbandry covered in this? That's what I think we're getting to.
Senator Thatcher, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good animal husbandry has a broad exemption for legitimate animal husbandry practices. I would imagine, though, if the cow was the companion, the sheep was the companion, was considered a pet, and someone was doing this as a threat of domestic violence, that would be a different story.
Okay. All right. Other questions? All right. Ladies, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3468. This bill is not ready to move. My understanding, there is some additional work. So public hearing is closed. It will be reset. And now we're going to go back to House Bill 2571, which we recessed, reopen the public hearing, and I'm going to go ahead and call up Ryan Lufkin, Michael Savaggio, and Kevin Campbell, and Kimberly McCullough. Do four. All right. Gentlemen, as you know, we are somewhat short on time, so if you can keep your remarks focused. This bill is not ready to move forward, so we're not going to work it today, but I do want to get your testimony on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today on behalf of the Chiefs and the Sheriff's Associations, both in support of House Bill 2571A. There is a small technical amendment. It's, I believe, the Dash 8 amendment. So we do support the addition or the committee's consideration of adding that amendment. It's a one-word oversight, and there is no real additional substantive changes that we believe are necessary to the bill. This was one that's been negotiated significantly among a wide range of parties, and we believe this would allow agencies to move forward to implement a body-worn camera system permissively and in a way that would benefit the public. And so we support the bill. I did submit my written testimony, and I don't want to say anything more because of the shortness of time, but we do support the bill and appreciate the committee's consideration. Thank
you. I appreciate that. And I should have said this earlier. If you have written testimony, please don't read it. Of course, we'll have it for our review. Michael, you're going next?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio, representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. I did submit testimony to OLIS. I would like to just put a couple of brief things on the record in addition to our support of 2571 as it currently stands and with the amendments. The version currently provides for local governments to establish their own policies in addition to the policy floor that the bill supports. So I just want to make clear that we support what Mayor Hales and Representative Williamson described, which was that local governments and local law enforcement agencies will be describing their own policies in addition to what we see in this bill. We've had a broad discussion about privacy and civil records, and we originally envisioned stronger protections on this, but we feel that the current bill represents a fair and appropriate compromise. We expect that the current rules around public records will prevent footage from being subject to records requests before the completion of any associated legal proceedings, although the footage, of course, may be used as part of those proceedings in an investigatory or evidentiary capacity. So we're pleased to support the bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ryan?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Lufkin. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County and a member of the Law Enforcement Responsible Technologies Group that helped to work on this bill in collaboration with some of the partners here today. And I want to state that we're highly supportive of this bill. It was strongly negotiated. It has a wide-ranging impact on how law enforcement will do its job and then subsequently how the prosecution of criminal cases will occur. So I'd just like to highlight, as I did in the House, that this bill represents the beginning of one of the most fundamental changes to how police will collect evidence since the invention of the police report, because we're envisioning that this video will be available in all criminal prosecutions for which there are police officers involved, which is basically every single criminal prosecution. And that has wide-ranging impacts on how prosecution occurs. And this bill does a good job at getting at some of the issues that devolve from that in additional evidence, because our system is not really set up right now to handle hours and hours of video footage coming into every single criminal case. So some of the features that I want to highlight for your attention in this bill are it does set a requirement for law enforcement to turn on their video camera at a specific point in time, which is when the officer develops reasonable suspicion that a crime or traffic infraction has begun and the officer begins to make contact with the individual involved, and does not allow for the termination of that video to occur until after the officer has ceased his contact. That is the general standard that applies. And then the bill permits local agencies to exempt from that requirement when there are concerns for privacy, when there are concerns for safety, when there are concerns for exigency, because as the folks that were around the table negotiating this language, I think came to realize, the permutations of different scenarios that can occur inside people's homes, inside hospitals, inside schools, with juveniles, each community is going to grapple with those issues with respect to recording differently. The other features of the bill that are important to us, it does create a minimum retention period of 180 days and a maximum retention period of 30 months. And that was intended to get at both the minimum required time to file a lawsuit and the maximum required time to file a lawsuit. The 8 amendment that is not ready to be moved today, but which we support, clarifies, I think, what was just an unintended drafting issue, which is that we're not intending to destroy evidence that exists for criminal investigations. This was essentially a cleaning mechanism for video that has no purpose any longer. And that time range when that cleaning was supposed to happen is at 30 months, but it was not intended to force officers to go destroy physical evidence of crimes they're currently investigating. And so that's what the Dash 8 was intended to do. One of the features that's important to us as prosecutors is that there's a 60-day time limitation to bring a defendant who is in custody to trial. That time limitation is already extremely difficult to meet on your average case. And what we envision happening in cases where you have, you know, sometimes 20 or 40 hours of video footage is that time limitation is going to be really just impossible to meet, particularly with the amount of video editing that we're envisioning that needs to happen, because not all video is just going to be played before a jury. Some parts are going to be admissible, some parts are inadmissible. This statute provides the court the ability to weigh that issue and appropriately grant good cause exceptions to that 60-day window. And that was extremely important to us to get this bill in a place where we think it would be workable. And then finally, on the public records point, we are very happy with the language that was crafted. It's a difficult issue to grapple with. The concerns over privacy are fairly extreme when you have most officer contacts not resulting in an arrest. And we've already seen examples in other jurisdictions where the kind of blanket request, give me all your video, has simply drowned law enforcement agencies from being able to actually comply with legitimate public records inquiries. So the language that we've crafted was intended to get at that issue, get at the actual applications, make sure that they are constricted to real specific events so that we can respond to them appropriately and release public records when appropriate. So it's a difficult issue, but I think that this bill has really reached the right compromise on all these issues, and we're very pleased to be able to support it.
All right, thank you. Kimberly?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon in support of House Bill 2571A. I'd just like to point out that there were initially several different competing bills that were introduced, and one of those was a bill that that we were very strongly supporting, and there were a number of provisions in that bill that ended up getting imported into this bill, which is why we support it, because it was really a compromise between all the different competing concerns. And this issue in particular, as was already pointed out, is fairly complex because there really are competing values of wanting to increase transparency, but at the same time protect privacy, in particular of people who have encounters with law enforcement, where if those videos just sort of ended up on YouTube en masse, the repercussions for individuals could be fairly serious, particularly when, you know, the court of public opinion doesn't always give people that innocent until proven guilty slant that our criminal justice system does. I just want to highlight a few things that we really like about this bill, in particular the fact that it prohibits the use of facial recognition technology, so that we can come back and have a conversation about that if that is something that that law enforcement wants to use in the future. Also, the fact that it requires cameras to record continuously and that they can't be turned off once an officer is engaging with someone where there's reasonable suspicion or probable cause to suspect that a crime has been committed. The public records piece was really complicated here, and I just want to point out that some earlier versions had a few things in there that are not in this, one of those is there was the allowance of disclosure if everyone in a video consented, and then also allowance of disclosure if there was a use of force or a misconduct investigation. It is our hope that the way that the public records piece is drafted right now would allow for those types of footage to actually get disclosed, because we believe those types of footage, it really is in the public interest to get that out. Of course, obviously, after there's investigation, trial, things like that. That's something we're really going to have to see as courts interpret this public records piece. And so if this bill hasn't struck the right balance, this may need to be an ongoing conversation. But we think that we have done the very best that we can at this point.
I appreciate the kind of the brevity that we have here. Any questions?
Just Senator Thatcher. One that's been kind of bothering me, and I'm not real clear on it, is if I, for instance, had an interaction with the police, not me as a legislator, but a person has an interaction with a police officer, and those are not always, well, friendly encounters, and they're stressful. And you're going through this, and afterwards you're thinking, wow, did that just happen? I mean, did that really just happen? Can I look at the tape? Would I be able to access that?
Right, and I think that was what I was getting at there, is that I feel like those types of things, it really is in the public interest for a person to be able to view their own video if they're the only one in the video and they're consenting to it. But that is something that's going to have to be worked out by the courts and the DAs and you know, when this is actually interpreted. So that's not articulated, but I don't, you know, that's a complicated policy issue as well. You may want to make some comments about that as well.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, it is already the practice of law enforcement agencies when there's a case, for instance, where you are in an encounter and you either file a complaint or want to look at the video, they want you to see it. Mm-hmm. It's beneficial to them. It's beneficial to you. And a lot of times after reviewing it, you know, sometimes there's complaint made and then you look at it and you feel like, oh, okay, I understand now. Or it could be a legitimate concern that you've raised. And so it's in the best interest of an agency to actually allow you to see that. I don't think that this bill is designed to prevent that. Mm-hmm. If you said, I think we're more concerned about the release of a video where you're a party to it, you may not have an interest in seeing your encounter on some media site. So that's really the concern we were trying to get at. But I think agencies have it in their interest to want you to be able to view footage when there's an issue or a concern.
Okay. All right. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you describe what the definition is of approximate date and time? That's a pretty vague term.
Senator Gelser, Chair Prezansky, the goal behind that language was to avoid the blanket request of give me all your video for officer whoever or give me all your video for the last year. So the idea was, let's say that if you're going to make a request, that request should be specific to as much information as you know about the event, so that we can deny the request if it's something super overbroad like I just described. And again, these public records issues go not just to the agency, but if appealed to the district attorney or the attorney general and then to court. So it's a matter of allowing the parties to hone in on what the request is based on the approximate date, time, and location of the event, some pieces of information that allow us to get at what you're truly after in a legitimate sense and not overexpand the release.
May I follow up? So in some cases, let's say there's a person that a mentally ill person that's had an encounter that they have described to mm-hmm. someone, and they cannot pinpoint the exact time or even the exact day. Mm-hmm. They know that it was the evening time, maybe sometime in the third week of August. Would that count as an approximate if they could say in this location, the third week of August, between 4 and 7 p.m.?
Senator Gelser, yes. The answer is yes. The goal behind this language was not to restrict a person from identifying the piece of video that they want. The goal of this language was to prohibit blanket requests for all video. So the idea is not to prohibit the person who has a challenging time remembering what specific day the event occurred. The goal was, let's find the piece of video that you're asking us for and not release weeks and weeks of video that you're not asking us for. So I think the answer to your question is yes.
And I think there'd also be a cross check on that based on this individual having a name that's going to be probably in a police report. They'd be able to access that much easier. Again, this is really for that broad net.
And one last follow-up with that broad net. In talking with some of the newspaper publishers, if they were doing some sort of an investigative report perhaps around a specific officer and the types of interactions they had with women or the types of interactions they had with people who were mentally ill, could that request, if they described what that investigation was about in the public interest, be for this officer over the course of a month when police reports have identified they were encountering a mentally ill person or a person of color or a woman?
Senator Gelser, again, the answer is yes. I think that request would get handled. It's not going to be prohibited by this language. The language is intended to narrow down what the request actually is. And I think on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the submission actually is, would get either approved or denied by the agency, go through the DA's office and through the courts to attempt to get at what the meat of the issue is and then weigh it whether or not it meets the public interest test. Yeah. So I think that's the goal of this language, but I wouldn't want to get pinned down on exactly what that is, because it could be the request is, well, we think Officer Jones is a bad guy, so give us everything he's ever done. No, right? And that would probably be denied.
Yeah, there's enough checks and balances in this process. If there's those allegations, and if the department says no, then there's a check with the district attorney as to, because it's a public records request, and if they say no, they can still go to court. And then if they have, let's say, affidavits from individuals, the court's going to take all that and weigh it. So to me, there's going to be those checks and balances to ensure, again, it's just not, we just want to go fishing.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. I'm going to bring up our next panel. Our next panel includes Greg Peden, Gail Meyer, Ellen Miller, and Bill Johnstone. And again, I know this is kind of crunched, but we have limited time, so if we can get stuff on the record, this bill, again, is not moving today. And so I just want to try to capture the high points that we need to put on the record.
Can't do it first. I've been selected. Chair Prezansky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have members of our association have already encountered their caseloads where they're the officers in the field, the agencies in the field are using body cameras. It has made a huge difference. It's allowed that lawyer to independently assess exactly what's gone on. It separates out the confusion between the police reports and what it is the client is saying, and so that it helps focus and target the investigation and subsequent follow-up. And this has all been a very good thing from our perspective. So not only do we observe that the use of body cameras de-escalates a situation greatly, we know that everybody behaves better when the body cameras are on, it also assists in an accuracy in a determination of the facts that are at issue in a criminal case. So we heartily embrace the idea that more body camera, more footage is a good thing for everyone. We would have preferred a mandate that all agencies use them, but we didn't carry the day on that. It is in our interest in promoting recording in a maximal way, then, that we would like to register our disgruntlement with the release provisions under Section 6 that deals with public records. We would have preferred that to be much tighter than the language that we currently see. When the bill was heard over on the House side, the protections were under 502 of public records law, and it was amended after the public hearing, and so now this is the first opportunity where we have to be heard on it now being in 501. Here's our concerns. There's no express restriction here that when footage is relevant to an ongoing criminal proceeding, that footage will not be released until conclusion of the criminal case through the sentencing proceeding. We're quite certain that that the language as it currently exists is loose enough that there could be times when this footage would be released to the media. Right now, police reports often are released to the media while a criminal case is ongoing. As a matter of fact, broadcast media gets the police reports often by the 11 o'clock news hour, 10 days before the criminal defense lawyer ever sees the police reports. So we can't say that as the Section 6 is currently structured, that it would restrict or prohibit this footage from getting out when there is an ongoing criminal proceeding that is relevant to the footage. So we would have preferred language that would have clearly said that when footage is relevant to an ongoing criminal proceeding, it cannot be released until conclusion of the criminal case through the sentencing proceeding, with the exception that if the footage is introduced and becomes relevant during the course of a court proceeding and is displayed or used or referenced in open court, then of course it could be. With that, we're happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I'll cut right to the point. I signed up as neutral today because we believe that there does need a bill and support the efforts that have been made so far to get a bill, but there are three concerns that we have with the public records part of the bill. Right now, we are opposed to the face blurring section of the statute. We understand that there is a right of privacy in some circumstances, then that people have a right to that. We think there is other language that we can support that would achieve that objective, and other states have passed this similar language. And the example I will give you is the state of North Dakota. I think I mentioned to the chair that I have that language. I will submit it to the committee today. And it goes something like this. In places where there is an expectation of privacy, a home, a bathroom, somewhere where you have an expectation of privacy, those recordings could be exempted from public records and we would be okay with that. But in places where there's no expectation of privacy, a sidewalk, driving down the road, those recordings should be public record. And we think that's a distinguishment that makes sense, that follows current law, and would provide a level of privacy where people would expect it. Second, we're very concerned with the specific date and time requirement in the language that was just discussed. As you know, and I think as Senator Gelser was alluding to, the media newspapers often ask for a wide range of records when making a public records request. The example that I will give you here was referenced earlier by the mayor. They're under this federal Department of Justice process now for their police force. Well, I think it's a fair assumption that the media will want to see a variety of date and times for recordings, and they may make a request to say, we want to see every police recording from June 1 to December 31st to see if those reforms have taken hold. What's the success been? On my reading of the bill right now would suggest that if I don't ask for, my clients don't ask for the very specific date and time of every one of those incidents, we could not make that broad example request, and that's the whole point of getting some sort of systematic reform into the system. Finally, we think there is an overriding demand right now in the public interest for recordings of use of force. The mayor used an example earlier where they relied on somebody to lean out their apartment window with their phone camera to make the recording that we released. Why wouldn't we want the official recording on a use of force scenario to produce an accurate depiction of what occurred in those events? For the efficacy of time, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. What I'm going to do here, I'm right now at 10 o'clock. I'm going to start losing members. I've got two bills that are ready for work sessions. I'm going to recess this. We're going to continue. And if necessary, I will stay and take the public testimony as a subcommittee so we can ensure we get everyone on this bill. We have one other bill that we're not going to get to today, and this is for Jad and Carl. I know y'all are set for House Bill 3399A. I just don't think we're going to be able to get the testimony in based on I've got another two, three people here. And if y'all want to hang in there, we can see if we can get the get some of the testimony in or not. But I'm letting you know if we don't, we'll get it rescheduled for this next week. So with that,
Mr. Chair, you can set it over. I'm available every day next week except Wednesday.
Except Wednesday. I know both of y'all are close by, and that's why I figured we could do that. Thank y'all very much. All right. So with that, I'm going to recess this public hearing right now, 2571, open up a work session on House Bill 2208A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you heard 2208 earlier this week. This deals with public records requests. The underlying bill adds a public code enforcement officer, such as a building code inspector, to request an exemption from public disclosure of their personal information. You have the proposed A2 amendments before you, which provide an absolute exemption to the information held by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Trainings for those who are certified by them. That information includes an exemption for residential addresses, telephone numbers, personal cellular numbers, and dates of birth. It also adds an emergency clause to the measure. The Department of Transportation let us know that they are okay with that. We have all of the paperwork back on this measure. It is ready to go.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment into House Bill 2208.
Senator Cruz moves the A2 amendment in House Bill 2208A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2208A as amended by the dash A2 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2208A as amended by the A2s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Thatcher.
Where do we stop with this? I question the wisdom of proceeding down piecemeal path like this. I really am not a big fan of it.
Would you prefer having it just across the board?
I think we need to have discussion. Yep. I mean, even have my address out there. I mean, I have to do it too, but it's just like, where do we stop?
I understand. I appreciate the comment. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion? Senator Thatcher's a no. Anyone else? Not seeing anyone else. Motion carries. Chair will carry 2208A to the floor. We'll close the work session. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2549.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you heard this one earlier in the month. This deals with collection of debts owed to the state when an estate has closed. You have a proposed dash one amendment which changes the entity receiving notice of a closed estate from the Department of Revenue to the state agency. We have all of the paperwork back on this. It is ready to go.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment into House Bill 2549.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A1 amendment into House Bill, the dash one amendment in House Bill 2549. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2549 as amended by the -1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruzman now moves House Bill 2549 as amended by the -1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Burdick, will you be our carrier on this one?
Happy to, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Burdick will be the carrier. We're closed the work session. I'm going to reopen the public hearing we're having on House Bill 2571. And for those who are up at the dais, please come forward again. I apologize for needing to do that, but I wanted to get those bills out today since we are not here tomorrow or Monday. And for committee members, I know you have other commitments. If you need to leave, feel free to do so. We'll continue to meet. And if necessary, I'll go into subcommittee mode.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, my name is Ellen Miller with CFM Strategic Communications, here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, or the OAB. With me today is Bill Johnstone, the President and CEO of the OAB. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 2571A. I will be brief so that Mr. Johnstone can explain the concerns of the OAB, but today the OAB is opposed to the bill as it is currently drafted. The OAB concerns are centered on the access to the footage captured by the police body cameras. This access is limited by the facial blurring requirement and the blanket exemption of all footage to public records disclosure unless proven in the public interest. This bill was intended to increase transparency and accountability of police agencies, and the OAB is concerned that due to the facial blurring requirement and the public records disclosure exemption, the engrossed bill does not meet this intent. We understand the need for this important legislation and the importance of balancing the concerns between privacy and access to the records. We ask for you to consider amending this legislation to increase access to the footage under public records law. Thank you for your time and consideration. I will now turn it over to Mr. Johnson, and I will be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Przanski and committee members. For the record, I am Bill Johnstone, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. I'm pleased to be here this morning to talk on behalf of more than 200 radio and television members across the state. Over our years of involvement in public policy at the Capitol, we placed a top priority on public records issues, of which there are many each session, including in this session, House Bill 2571A. We are here today in opposition to the bill as it is drafted. It's not a surprise for you to learn that our tendency to support free and open access to all government records. However, at the same time, we have been more than willing over the years to work with legislative leaders to craft compromises on tough issues such as those contained in House Bill 2571A. In the House, we expressed our concern over a couple of key provisions in the bill, and we told House members that we would take our case to the Senate. Well, here we are this morning. Our concerns rest in two areas. Our first and more important point is we want to raise deals with fairly complicated issue, and that is, of course, the facial blurring requirements. As drafted, the bill requires an agency to edit a video recording in a manner so as to render unidentifiable, before disclosure, all faces of persons in the recording. This facial blurring requirement dramatically reduces the transparency and accountability benefit of the police body cameras. The easiest way to resolve this issue is to remove the blurring issue from the bill. But if you decide to include it, we would suggest requiring custodians of record to make the facial blurring determination as a part of the public interest determination. Second, on a blanket basis, the bill exempts police camera audio and video recordings, whether digital or analog, from public disclosure. This is much too broad, and further, the public interest test can be very expensive and a lengthy process. We believe there are clear cases in the use of police body cameras where the footage should be subject to public disclosure. This would include incidents involving the use of force by law enforcement officers and when each individual who is recorded consents to disclosure. Our specific request is that you consider an amendment to House Bill 2571A that would include these exceptions to the blanket public records exception. I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, but emphasize this final comment, please. The OAB record of dealing with public records issues over the years in this building indicates that while we generally favor public disclosure, we also recognize legitimate issues of privacy. And to that end, we have appreciated working with legislators to find what we can call a smart middle ground. Mr. Chair, if you and your colleagues can see your way clear to set up a work group to deal with such issues as those we have raised this morning, we will commit to our very best effort to find that smart middle ground and do so very quickly. And with that, I end my comments.
Thank you very much. Questions for either individual?
Just a real quick one.
Yes.
Would you rather have the bill as is or no bill at all and a work session? Just curious. And a work group, I meant, not work session.
Yeah.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, at this time, the OAB does oppose this bill. We do recognize the importance of this legislation, but our position is oppose.
Thank you very much. So the last person I have scheduled to give testimony is John Lloyd Scharf. Mr. Scharf, why don't you come forward? While he's coming forward, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2571? Not seeing anyone. So, Mr. Scharf, you'll be our last person, and I'm going to be going into a subcommittee of the full committee based on membership at this point.
Okay, I want to start out just by correcting the record. My name is Scarf, like scarf around the neck.
Got it.
Okay, now, in answer to her question, I'd rather it not be at all, because once you give this as a regulation, you give permission, and you have no consequences if somebody decides to do something other than this. And for all the legislative intent, I don't see it in the wording. I have to say that if I see a group of officers, I consider that a really dangerous situation in which the citizen involved is most likely to be hurt. Okay, I was not allowed to bring in a sign that I had that gave the dates and times and names. I will tell you what happened on May 9th at 10:15 approximately in a park in this town. An officer chased down someone. He set his dog on them. She apparently, according to his testimony, shot a pistol, a 22 that was like the one that shot Reagan. And when you look at the report, the autopsy, from what they said, I can't see the whole thing because of public records restraints. There's nothing about, did she have gunshot residue on her hand? And what we know is the bullet came through her behind her left ear and came in her back, exited from her head here, and exited from her back here, okay? So we know that she wasn't facing towards him, and he had sicked the dog on her. Maybe we would see that if there would have been a video, we would have been able to say, yes, she was carrying a weapon, and yes, she did fire it, and yes, it was aimed at the officer and not the attacking dog. Okay? I really like Oregon. I was born and raised here. I like our Constitution. It says, treatment of arrested or confined persons. No person arrested or confined in jail shall be treated with unnecessary rigor. I have to tell you, when every time I see an officer hit someone, that's unnecessary rigor. And I'll tell you why. I worked in corrections for many years, for decades, and I did all kinds of restraint. And every time you hit someone, It doesn't restrain them. It does exactly the opposite. I worked as a psychiatric aide and saw the same thing.
Mr. Scarf, I need you to focus on the bill regarding the body cameras.
I understand. I am, and this is focused on the bill. Don't try to go somewhere else. This has to do with why is it the officer gets his face blurred? If I have 10 officers on a spot, and I have, and the night of this issue that I am trying to tell you about, I went out this year to the same park to take a look at it. Then I heard some, heard a bunch of officers going to a certain place. There were 12 of them, 12 plus. Oh.
Mr. Scarf, what I understand from your testimony so far, you said that you oppose the bill. The bill does, in fact, require body cameras to be used. But is it the issue? Is it because it calls for blurring the images at this point?
That's part of it.
Could you please focus? I need you to please focus on what your issues are. We've already lost most of my members, and I'd like to get relevant to the issue.
That wasn't my fault that you decided to hold me for last. I'm trying to get to the reason why there is. This is a very complicated issue, and you want me to do it in a paragraph or two paragraphs, and I can't do that. I sent you emails, and not all of it was in there.
Okay. So, Mr. Scarf, we now are at 10:15. I will be glad to listen to you for another 5 minutes and taking the testimony. You are more than welcome to put whatever you want to in writing, submit it to the committee, and we'll have that as part of the record. We're trying to accommodate you since you are here that you can, in fact, be heard, but we are already 15 minutes beyond our time.
All right. Then for 5 minutes,
Please proceed.
I speak uninterrupted?
Well, I'd like for you to stay relevant to the bill that's before us.
That is a sort of a judgment call, and that's what officers do when they're in a use of force. They have a judgment call, and when they do that, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, okay, you have justifiable immunity. Isn't that correct? Okay, you don't answer questions. You just like to tell me what's relevant and is not relevant, but I can't ask you questions. Here's the
point. If you'd like to set up a time to come meet with me and talk about these offline where we can have a discussion, I'm more than willing to do that. But right now we're taking your testimony.
Okay,
and if you want to give us
testimony. Bottom line here, your law is not complex enough to deal with this situation. It allows officers to engage in censorship, and then you want to say we're going to do it on a basis of whether it has to do with a civil situation, and it may be a criminal situation that has a longer length for the statute of limitations.
Okay.
Okay. I'll talk to you.
That'd be great. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for giving us your testimony. We're going to go ahead and adjourn the subcommittee on House Bill 2571. And at this point, we have, for the record, we have bills that are being carried over and will be reposted, I'm assuming, is going to be the term. House Bill 2333, House Bill 2571. House Bill 3164, House Bill 3399, and House Bill 3468, I believe, are the ones that we need to cover. The other bills, 2038 has been reported out with Johnson being the carrier, 2693 reported out with the chair being the carrier. On the work sessions, we have House Bill 2208 reported out with the carrier being the chair. And House Bill 2549, Burdick being the carrier, and House Bill 3347 being carried over. Ladies, does that take care of everything?
Yeah.
All right, with that, we're adjourned for the day. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much.